the size of a given molecule, but the fact that dry nitrogen gas is free of water vapor in it, and that might be one of the factors. But Paul, please, what's your comment?
Yeah, I was just going to mention the shuttle ties were nitrogen as well. So they really pumped them up with high pressure. You know, I mean, they were as big as a truck, but, you know, truck ties, but they had a tremendous amount of pressure. So they were all nitrogen as well. Plus they had to, you know, withstand the extreme temperatures, the highs and lows of temperatures of space. So they used nitrogen in the space shuttle.
The so-called dry nitrogen, the most compact way you can put a lot of nitrogen in a bottle is to have it liquid and boil it off as a gas when you use it. And you would want the nitrogen in that bottle to be as dry as possible because any water there would freeze up your piping and your valves and whatever. So they want it to be super dry, liquid nitrogen in the tank is my guess, so that you get nothing but nitrogen coming back out. Bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
I agree with you, Dick. I mean, you can store it all kinds of different ways. I think you don't necessarily have to store it as a liquid. You can store it as a dry gas. Once you've separated the oxygen from the nitrogen, you've already separated the argon and the water vapor. So you can just use less severe pressure tanks to keep it only as a gas, and use it for tires and such. You really wouldn't want to expose any of this rubber to actual liquid nitrogen, because at those temperatures, the rubber would become rather brittle, and that would probably cause a lot of fatigue problems with the material.
A tank full of compressed nitrogen, I'll bet you it's got a very small fraction of the amount of gas of liquid. So if you can tolerate the liquid in the tank, you're going to compress a lot more, you're going to put a lot more nitrogen there. And then to have the right kind of heat exchanging hardware to make sure that the nitrogen that you're putting into the tire is pure gas, and that there's no longer any liquid left, and it's heated up to room temperature, that I think is doable. Do they do all that? I don't know. Back to you, Roy, KQIW.
I would imagine either way is doable. One is better suited for small situations. Others are more suited for industrial applications. You can do it with either way, but it's probably a lot easier for Joe Public to get himself a tank charged up with dry nitrogen than it is to get a tank full of liquid nitrogen and then have to run a lot of plumbing and heating and other types of things so that you don't freeze your tires when you're doing this.
There's something else going on here, Roy. If I had a tank of highly compressed nitrogen, let me pick a number, 100 atmospheres, at room temperature, and then I vent it out of the tank into a tire, because I'm expanding it, it's going to get super cold. So you're going to have a cooling nitrogen problem, even if you start off with a gas or start off with a liquid. So in either case, I think you're going to have a nice long piece of tubing to make sure that the nitrogen that you're inserting into that tire is up to room temperature at the time you insert it. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
I agree with you, Dick. It's just a matter of orders of magnitude. You know, if you're dealing with gaseous nitrogen under pressure, the temperature will dip a little bit. But, you know, if you start getting any of your liquid nitrogen into your tire, again, it's minus 195 degrees centigrade, that's real problematic. So, again, it depends what you're doing. If you're filling up a enormous tire, yeah, you got to deal with those types of things. If you're Joe Public and you like to put dry nitrogen in your car tires, you're never going to get to the point where the amount of pressure is going to freeze the rubber of your tires, I don't think.
But even air ordinary atmospheric air, which is what, roughly 80% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and a couple of other inert gases. Air and nitrogen both obey pretty close the ideal gas law. The reason I'm mentioning that is that there's been a couple of people on my mark from time to time saying that as the tire gets hot on a summer day, nitrogen will not expand as fast as air. There I disagree. I think both air and nitrogen obey the ideal gas law. And you might want to say a few words as to what that is. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I think it's like we read each other's mind. I was listening to a very similar conversation a couple of weeks ago where a gentleman suggested that he pumps his tires with dry nitrogen just because of that reason. And I quoted PV equal NRT, which is Boyle's law, which is the ideal gas law, where it makes absolutely no sense that whether it's a oxygen 20% nitrogen 80% mix or a nitrogen 100% mix, PV still equals NRT, and pressure is related to temperature. So I was even going to do a little spiel on it. It was on one of my Rolodex for some day in the distant future. So we think alike there. I agree with you. I think, again, what might be happening is either placebo effect or there's something else going on that affects the situation due to the difference of dry nitrogen versus just an air pump putting in regular atmosphere with relative humidity going in there.
D2IS coming.
Yes, Bill.
Just wanted to mention that I did once work at a place that had nitrogen storage and, I believe, generation on site. And I think it doesn't take I don't think it takes a very large manufacturing operation, you know, for it to make sense to do that yourself on site. And also, I think that when you're doing those things, I don't know everything about it, but I think they don't store at high pressure. I think that they depend on their refrigeration and their cooling to you know, collect that volume of nitrogen. And if they lose cooling, I think it vents off and they don't attempt to, you know, contain that pressure. So, you know, it's one thing to make something very insulated, and you tend to have pretty large containers, I think, when you're doing this. And it's another thing entirely to try to make that size container stand up to any kind of internal pressure. AC2IS.
Well, Bill, I you know better than me, having worked with a place like that, but I think it's kind of a mix of both things. They do tend to pressurize the gases that they separate, the oxygen, nitrogen, argon, whatever they're mixing, whatever they're liquefying. They pressurize it. They also allow it to vent somewhat to decrease its temperature and require less pressure. So I think it's a mix of those things. It's possible, I mean, theoretically, you can, in fact, if you wanted to, for some strange reason, purchase on eBay the equipment necessary to do your own nitrogen and oxygen collection. It's very energy expensive, so if you have a cheap source of energy, it's not that awful. New York City, probably your electric bill would be ridiculous. You know, you could afford to just have it shipped in from where Lou is, you know, Hawaii, and still save some money. But it's doable. But I think it's a combination of things. It's not under no pressure. It's obviously under significant pressure, but they also have thermal insulation, and they also let the gases vent out and lower the temperature that way as well. Any other comments, questions, answers, statements, or what have you on this subject? Otherwise, I'll move on to my next little thing.
You can buy a tank of helium if you want to, and it's stored in the liquid form, but the tank itself is large, well-insulated, and continuously venting, because liquid helium at room temperature goes to some ridiculous temperature, some ridiculous pressure, I think, that a tank could not tolerate. So there's got to be some continuous venting to keep it cold enough so that you don't get to this ridiculous pressure. However, when I was running environmental chambers at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, we were buying bottles of dry nitrogen. Inside the bottle of dry nitrogen was liquid at room temperature. So to make a bottle strong enough to tolerate liquid nitrogen at room temperature is very doable. And then you would vent that liquid nitrogen into your chamber in order to make the chamber cold in a hurry. So that was one way of getting a lot of apparent refrigeration, cooling in a hurry. So nitrogen, you can keep in the liquid form in a strong container. But helium, I think you cannot do that. That's my remembrance of, because I remember seeing the liquid helium tanks, and they always had a lot of ice around their plumbing, and were always venting, and they were well insulated. AC2GS, K2RIW.
US2N.
Call recognized. Let me just put my 2 cents worth in. You have to understand what's going on. There's a phase chart of gas, liquid, and solid for things. And with liquid nitrogen to solid nitrogen, the equilibrium at one atmosphere, as we've been talking, is one minus 195 degrees centigrade. For liquid helium, the equilibrium point is 3 degrees Kelvin. That's a heck of a lot colder. So it's a function of pressure times the temperature. So the fact that its boiling temperature in one atmosphere is so much lower requires you to increase the pressure to offset that effect. So whereas you can build a strong enough tank to contain the pressures of oxygen and nitrogen rather easily, it becomes ridiculous, most likely. There's got to be some place in the jet propulsion lab where they've done it, but it must be ridiculous, the amount of pressure that's required to maintain liquid helium where the outside environment is room temperature. Yeah, Paul, what do you want to say?
Those tanks that Dick is talking about, we used to use all the time. My guess, Dick, you're talking about the ones that are about 5 feet high. They have valve on top, the cap. You can take the cap off, and then you hook your regulator up to it, and then off you go. Put that into whatever you're going to put it in. We used to put it into piping systems to test the piping system and make sure the meter didn't drop. Come back a couple hours later and make sure the meter didn't drop after you pressurized it. But those tanks were all liquid. They would come 20, I think around 2,400 pounds per square inch in the tank, and that was all liquid. I mean, when you open the tank, if it was a humid day, it would all frost up around the valve system, and you could watch it all frost up. It's pretty cool. Back to you, Russ.
Okay, very good. I'd be interested to know if there are any really good liquid helium containment. I think ultimately, if price is no object, you might be able to actually build something structurally that strong. But I think ultimately, everyone's kind of decided to let it vent, and then if economically feasible, to recapture the vented helium and recondense it once again.
The MRI machines use liquid helium in order to get to the temperature where they get superconductivity of that magnetic coil. I'm guessing they pour liquid helium in there, but it has to be continuously venting in order to maintain that cold temperature. Is that your recollection? And in the medical world, you probably come close to MRI machines. I bet you they're always slowly venting, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
they're venting, hopefully they're designed reasonably well in which they recycle the helium. They'll take the gas that they vent, and they'll trap it and collect it in a gas trap, and then they'll ship it back, or they'll bring it down to the basement where they have a condenser, and they'll recycle it. A long time ago, about a year or so ago, I did a story about how there was an MRI machine in a new MRI machine in a hospital environment where all of a sudden everyone and their brother noticed that their iPhones had gone dead in it. And the reason why was because the recapture of the helium wasn't particularly good. And helium was leaking into the environment of the MRI equipment. And once it gets into those small oscillator chips that Apple was making, it destabilized the oscillator chip, and it timed out, and the whole damn thing crashed. And it took about a week or so of just leaving it in room air to have the helium diffuse out of the chip before your iPhones returned to a working order. Say again, Wes?
Isn't that helium is always leaking?
Are you saying isn't helium always liquid?
Leaking.
Leaking, yes. For all that, well, I don't know if you can say that ultimately. For all practical purposes of our engineering and our ability to hold on to it, yeah, definitely. If you're saying that helium has this really strange quality that it can go through solid objects, a lot of solid objects are porous for liquid helium. That's true. But there are some that it's less porous.
Do you believe helium is the smallest possible diameter molecule, therefore it has the easiest ability to go through things like even a glass seal very slowly?
Hey, we'll get to you, Wes. I think so. I think that helium, it doesn't form molecules. They're by themselves, and they're probably, because I think we had this conversation as well a year or two ago, where helium is actually a little bit smaller than a hydrogen atom. So that's one of the reasons for helium's rather unique tendency. Plus the fact that at very low temperatures, helium becomes something called a superfluid. And superfluids act very strangely. They effectively have no viscosity. So you have something that's very, very small that can fit between things, and then it has no viscosity, and it's just going to ooze right through glass.
I have a device, it's a chamber, and it's a vacuum chamber, but it's also a helium cooled chamber with the helium compressor and the cold finger. A cold finger is actually a piece of copper that is cooled by circulating helium around that copper like chamber. The thing is made to work with 4 degrees Kelvin at max, and actually 4.5 Kelvin at max, and it's a chamber of diameter about 12 inches around that cylinder, and actually 16, and length of the cylinder is about 1.5 feet. At the very top of it, when I take that cup, cylindrical cup, there is a circular plate so I can put an electronic element and check it for whatever the electronic changes, electronic properties changes. And that there are sealed connectors. ask what was that used for by the West? It was used by a military contractor. That's the story, if I can make one. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, Wes, I remember seeing it. There are also YouTubes of other people. It's not that difficult to get it on eBay. The problem is getting the electronics that powers it. It's basically a cylinder that compresses helium gas, a thermal transductor that dissipates the heat, and then the pressure is released. telescope at the observatory in Germany. Multi-telescopic explorer. like most of the stuff was. A very good question, John, and I wish I had looked up the Schwarzschild radius as it relates to mass. If you want to wait a second or so, I'll see how my fingers are doing. Keep it up. has lack of a slack contact card that was only available at a Frankfurt auto show about a couple of months ago as well. Well, if you're going to be in Singapore soon, I have another technological marvel. Skywalker coming out on December 20th. You're bound to see one product that's on for you will probably be a selection of Coca-Cola products. They feature the main characters with light lasers that light up any time you touch the light. If you're wondering what kind of space magic allows power stuff, the answer is organic light. Diodes